So, Brad, your old friend Cheapy McGee got a deal the other day at Costco. Oh. I got a foosball table on the cheap. It was a $300 foosball table. I got it for $99. I felt like, all right, this is fun. It was a floor model type thing. They were getting rid of it. And so I brought it home, and we happened to set it up right next to the kitchen in the house. Really? And here is what has developed in the Kellett house now. We now have nightly foosball battles for who has to do dishes.
Oh, my gosh.
It's the greatest way because foosball is a game that no one can have skill at. No matter how agile and delicate your finger work is, no one is truly good at foosball. You're randomly flailing and the ball goes where it goes. And that's, it's sort of a metaphor for life. So that's how we now decide dishes in the Kellett household.
Oh, my God. I got to tell you, foosball has always kind of befuddled me. It's actually one of my least favorite games because here's my experience every time playing foosball. You're kicking the ball back and forth. And then all of a sudden it hits a dead zone on the table where nobody's little man can hit. And then finally, you look at your opponent, they look at you, you bump the table a few times, nobody can hit it. And then finally, somebody's got to scooch it out with their finger. And then you hit the ball back and forth until it inevitably finds another dead spot and the game is stopped again. I actually kind of hate the game.
So here is my eternal question with foosball. Just design that gap a half inch smaller. Everybody wins. You don't have to have that dead zone between. I never understood foosball why they do that. Also, why is the ball made out of compressed drywall? I don't know what that ball is made out of. It's the weirdest
bounce to it. It's the least nice sound. It doesn't have a good bounce to it. It's really a game designed for frustration.
Also, speaking of design, who designs that game? Oh. Who looks around at the world and goes, you know what we need? How about a box with sticks through it? And on the sticks are little dudes, and they'll kick a ball around. Like, it's the weirdest game to have designed. Like, I don't know the evolution of foosball. Like, where the did it come ex nihilo out of nothing? What is it?
It's got no finesse. You know how in chess you've got like the Birkenstein opening and the Schmidt remover. You've got two ways of playing foosball. You can either make your little guy kick, or you spin him so he spins, wah, 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 and something inevitably maybe hits and kicks that little piece around, drywall all around. There's only two ways to play: either kick or spin.
We have actually made the spin illegal in the Kellett house.
Oh, is that right? You're one of those.
Bradley, we're playing a more refined game of foosball in the Kellett house.
You've eliminated
one is
the
not
spin?
Allowed to spin when one plays foosball. There you go.
You've got one way to play.
Because you know what? It becomes a road to mania if you allow spinning. It just becomes cacophonous. You can't play with any sense of decorum if you're like, fuck it. People are just spinning nonstop. You're like, I'm out. I gotta go. Yes. I gotta go lie down in a quiet room.
Yes, well, we will not have a game of foosball without decorum.
And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about decorum and making comics.
And foosball and making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, the author of the Webcomics Handbook and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, author of Drive and Sheldon and author of Stripped, the comics documentary.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So, Dave! Let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And a reminder that you can be joining us live right now over at patreon.com/comiclab. There is the Live Gab group that comes and joins us every week for the live stream. And that show is also archived. So you can join us for the live chat and watching it live. Or if you happen to miss it for life or learning, then you can join us later on the archives. And Brad, quick question for you. Is a director considered an author? Are you an author of a film?
I've heard directors considered auteurs.
They will
say like somebody, Stanley Kubrick was an auteur. But I think once you become a director, you lose the H.
Well, okay, question for you. What do you have to do? This is unplanned. What do you have to do to become an auteur in comics?
Oh, man, that's a good question.
Have we ever had an auteur?
Oh, I think, I think like Art Spiegelman is considered an auteur. You know, I think Alison Bechdel is considered an auteur at this point. There's a few auteurs out there. I think once you've been on the New York Times a number of times, the bestseller list, and you hit that repeatedly, then I think like Raina, I think you can be considered an auteur.
Right. Like an auteur is basically just an author who has reached a pinnacle of personal achievement and style and distinctiveness. Right. Isn't that's what an auteur is.
And
right?
Gravitas. You and I are never going to be auteurs. We're lucky to be authors on most days. You've got to have gravitas.
What's funny is you got to lose the Bronx accent if you're going to become an auteur. You can, hey, I'm making a comic over here. I'm an auteur. Hey. Yeah, you're right. Watterson's probably an auteur. Yeah, you're right. We have auteurs.
But they've got gravitas.
Talk about an art form, though, where we would never self-describe as auteurs.
No. That's something that you can only be described as an auteur from the outside. No one puts that on their comics making resume.
And usually you have to have either an RP British accent or French to use the word auteur or very upper class East Coast. I think you can use auteur.
Yeah.
No one else gets to use that word.
So, Dave, I'm going to start us off with a great question here that came in from a $5 Patreon backer that I'll just put all my cards on the table here. A lot of the questions we get as soon as I see it, it's like, okay, I know what I'm going to say, or I know what I think about that, or it comes to me fairly quickly because we've been doing this show. We're in our fifth year, right? We've been doing this show for a while. Yeah. So some of it is kind of like, okay, I know the angle I'm going to take. This one set me back. And I had to really think, and I realized that I hadn't thought of this before, and I didn't know how I felt about it immediately. So I'm going to ask you and see what you think. Comes in from our Patreon backer, Garth, who says, at some point, we're all confronted with having to raise our prices. Often it's because of an increase in material cost or realizing we were undercharging. But lately, life itself has become more expensive. A price hike is simply enough with commissions or products, but seems a fraught prospect with ongoing subscriptions like Patreon. You've talked about unpublishing tiers that aren't working, but would you approach correcting for inflation in the same way? Would you ever unpublish your $5 tier to raise the price just because $5 doesn't go as far as it used to? Thanks in advance. And as always, I love the podcast. Now to mix my movie sign-offs, party on and be excellent to each other. So that comes from Garth. And here's the question in a nutshell. Dave, is it time to raise our Patreon tiers?
Well, this is a really neat question, because had you asked it for books or original art, I would have had a certain kind of question or a certain kind of answer.
Yeah.
But Patreon is a very different animal. So let me, I know this is a dodge for a second, but let me do books first and physical products first.
Yeah.
And then we can talk about artwork and then Patreon, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead. Stall for time. That's fine.
Yes, exactly. Because you know what? Like you said, let's just be honest about it.
Yeah.
Most of us as adults have not had to deal with rampant inflation. Like the last time it really hit, really, really hit, was in the 70s.
Yeah.
And most of us weren't operating businesses or doing work as cartoonists or artists.
No.
I mean, aside from Brad, you were probably in your third decade, I think, at that
point. I was in my third decade. Yeah, just as a livered spot explodes on my wrist. Yes. It was in my third decade.
Brad had sold his fourth horse and had started moving off of the farm. And
at that point, I stopped having to make my own ink, which was nice. I enjoyed that.
Still baling hay, but that's all right. So let's talk about books, because it's a very specific problem when you have a price printed on the product. Because whether it's at a Comic-Con or whether it's at a show, if you charge $35 and then people get it and they flip it over and it says $30 USD, and you're like, there is an umbrage that is unique to that people, and perhaps rightly so, because they feel like someone along the line is price gouging,
right,
or somehow they've been taken for a fool, or somehow there's been malfeasance of some sort.
Yeah.
And so what I'm getting at is, you kind of have to set it and stick with it when it comes to physical product prices, which is why Brad and I always suggest pricing in with a padding.
Yeah.
And that's why the Drive books are priced the way they're priced, because, like, for example, my Drive hardcovers are $55 now. They used to be $50. And you might be saying, $55 for a hardcover? Well, part of it is I'm going to be making that story and selling those hardcovers 5 years from now, maybe even farther than 5 years from now. So those have to price in inflation and rising costs and all that sort of stuff. And so I made the price what it was. But anyway, so that's a physical product. With art, what I do is I personally raise my prices about $5 every year. And that sort of allows for both what I think is an ever improving art career in terms of, like, I feel prouder and prouder of how my work is looking, and also that prices are rising. So I'm trying to work that in. Now, Patreon, to get to the question that I've artfully dodged for 5 minutes, is a very unique problem. I think what a great opportunity if you're looking at inflation and going, yikes, then this is a great opportunity to step away from $1 Patreon tiers. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can put that one to bed. Patreon themselves has already said mathematically, it is not a good tier to price at. So definitely you can move to two. But Brad, how would you handle the higher tiers for Patreon and inflation?
I'll tell you this right now. I would immediately, here's where I'd start. If you're starting a Patreon today, my advice would not be to start at a $2 level. I would immediately be considering a $3 level right off the bat. I wouldn't hesitate. Would I bump up to a $3 level from my current $2 level? I don't know that I would. I really don't know that I would. Number one, especially at the $2 level, it's not enough that it's going to make that big of a difference for the amount of problems that it might likely stir up, right? The uncomfortable conversations and just the logistics of doing all of that. It's going to be a lot of headache. Would I bump my $5 level, which is kind of my mid-interest rewards? No, I can't say that I would. And bumping up my $10 level, which is my high interest rewards, I don't know that I would touch that either. I am much more, I would, if I would do anything, it would be at the lowest level. I would have to feel a much bigger economic pinch personally before I would start to touch those. In other words, we are early in a swing, in an inflation swing. It would have to go a little bit longer for me to consider bumping that up. I'm very slow to upset the apple cart in that regard.
Right. Well, another way to look at this, and maybe it's helpful. Now, first of all, a huge caveat that neither Brad nor I are trained economists. So there might be someone literally tearing out their hair listening to Brad and I talk about inflationary policies and how to approach them. But, as of May, the annualized inflation rate, I think, was around 8% in the U.S. at least. I know it's different in the U.K. and in parts of the world. And it's going to be high for a while, both for fuel costs, for labor costs. We can already see, I mean, the war in Ukraine, we know that that's going to be ongoing for a while. We know that labor is going to be a pinch for a while. We know that the pandemic still has constricting cost problems around the world. And so I would imagine we're with, you know, somewhere between 7% and 10% inflation for the next couple. So anyway, where I'm getting with that is, let's say worst case scenario, it's 10% annualized inflation rate, right? If you were at a $2 level on Patreon, does that justify in your mind, Brad, jumping to a $3 level if the annualized inflation rate was only 10%?
Not yet. I'm going to stick with that. If I was giving advice to somebody starting and launching their Patreon right now, I would say start at three instead of two. Because I've actually always, for the last couple of years, I've been thinking, you know, we always tell people one is a horrible choice. Two is much better. And then it's getting to the point that I would, if you're starting out, I'd say three. And then that's going to have a knock-on effect a little bit, because we've always said 2, 5, and 10 was kind of the sweet spot.
And for those of you that don't like math, just think that Brad is talking about ice cream sandwiches. One, that's a terrible choice. Two is great. Three, oh boy, looking increasingly promising. Yeah. So, you know.
it's the ice cream sandwich effect on economics.
Exactly.
But for Patreons, we've always kind of said the sweet spot for setting up your tiers is 2, 5, and 10. $2, that's support, just support. You don't give away significant rewards at the $2 level. $5 is your mid-interest rewards, $10 your high interest, and then you can build out from there as you see fit. I would say starting out at three would be a good idea today. But again, I'll be honest with you. I am not about to change my $2 level right now just because of logistics and just the headaches it's going to cause. I don't know that it's going to be worth it. And that the effect that inflation is having on my budget, mm-hmm. I can mm-hmm. offset so easily by taking on an extra commission or maybe, you know, adjusting my Kickstarter, right, doing stuff right. like that.
One
it's
more
so
eBay,
easy yeah. to account for that upsetting the ecosystem that I've created on Patreon just isn't a good fit for me.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the Fed works so hard to fight inflation is because it yeah. just makes it so hard to do a basic business planning yeah. when you have higher inflation rates. Because there's a lot of weird gray areas where you're like, ha, I mean, I could raise prices, yeah. but is it really hurting me? I mean, yes, it is, but it's not ruinous, but it's also my margins are way down now. Right. And so I think we can all admit, not really getting a running start on this question with pre-thought. I think we can all admit it's just weird to operate in an inflationary time.
Yeah.
And as an artist, and I like Brad, I personally wouldn't do anything. I hadn't been planning on doing anything. I tend to think that I would do something maybe every second year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like every 2 years, if inflation is sticking with us for, you know, year on year on year.
Yeah.
Then that's probably a good time to change my rates. And Brad, let me ask you, let's say it's 2 years from now and Dave goes, yeesh, we've had 2 years of 8% annualized inflation. I'm going to raise my $2 tier to $3. Mm-hmm. How do I technically do that, Brad? Can you take people? Do I lock the current $2 tier and create a new $3 tier? Or do I say to everyone on the $2 tier, hey, next month, we're all going to become $3. Well, yeah. Get on board the inflation train. Choo-choo. We're leaving the station.
Well, I think both parts of your question have things that I want to talk about. Number one, okay. I think you're absolutely right. In other words, I would wait at least until the first quarter of next year before I'm making any changes, right?
Okay.
If inflation yep. sticks around that long, then we've got to address it. So the first part of your question, I think unwittingly had a lot of answers, and that is...
that is the most bad description of my answer I've ever... You know, I got to tell you, Dave, I think that your answer unwittingly yeah. was actually pretty good.
Yeah. No, I don't think you were planning it that way, but I think that gives us...
that you just described our friendship. That's great. Yeah. Unwittingly, it worked out all right.
Yeah, you stumbled right into something good for a change. No, but I do think that we should wait off until the first quarter to make any changes. And then if you do, then I think it's a question of unpublishing a tier. And as we talked about in the past, what you do with unpublishing is that's an actual setting on Patreon. What unpublishing does is it keeps all the patrons who are at that level, but they're not going to get rewards anymore. Okay. And you tell those people that's the situation. You give them a month to adjust their rewards accordingly and mm-hmm. adjust their tiers accordingly. And you set up a new tier that replaces that they can jump to if they want to. Now, when you unpublish, let's call it between a $2 and a $3. When yep. you unpublish your $2 tier, all those $2 patrons stay, but it disappears for people who are coming in new and are considering what tier they want to join up to. They don't even see the $2. They only see the $3. And then at that point on, what you're going to find out, because I've talked a number of people through unpublishing just in the past year for different projects that they've asked my advice on. And here's what happens a lot of times. Nobody, you unpublish that tier, nobody jumps. And it's and then they email me and they say, nobody moved. And it's like, this is now where you've got to play a little bit of the long game and to communicate, right? Because you sent out the message, you sent out lots of messaging saying, hey, you got to move from two to three, but they're not checking their mail or they didn't get them or they didn't understand it. So now you've got to just stop posting any rewards at that level and then post them at the higher levels and then check in with those $2 tier people every now and again saying, just in case you're wondering, you know, here's where the rewards are, blah, blah. But you've got to play the long game because I unpublished a $1 tier years ago. I still have about 60 people at the $1 tier. They're just hanging out there, which is fine. You know?
Can I jump in for a minute? Because here's what I think. Like going back to the thought earlier that we really let's round up. We only have a 8 to 10% inflation rate right now. But if you lock in all those old people on the unpublished tier of $2, Brad, that's now an established cost such that new people coming in at a $3 level, which is, you know, a full dollar above what the over the inflation rate. They're kind of dollar cost averaging your overall rate for everyone, if you think about it. So they're kind of covering the cost of inflation is what I'm getting at. So even if the vast, vast majority of people don't bump, if you have a small percentage that do jump up to what is, I guess, a 50% jump on the previous tier, that'll cover it. You'll be okay is what I'm getting at there.
Yeah. And then, like I said, at that point, it's just a question of playing that long game, continuing to post at those higher levels, communicate with the people who are at the unpublished levels. And you can goose them along slowly but surely. So that's I think, my advice. Wait till the next quarter of next year, the first quarter of next year, then make a decision. And then at that point, it becomes a question of unpublishing. So, Dave, are you ready for our second question of the day?
I am indeed, my friend. Now, having solved the problem of inflation.
Yes. Now from inflation, we'll go to setting up a set for your comic. This is a great one. Comes in from our Patreon backer, Ferret Williams, who says, do you have any advice on designing the backgrounds or the sets for comics? I'm thinking the rules of theater stage design are applicable here, which includes having at least two entrances so a character can enter from whichever direction is needed, which is especially important when speech bubbles are involved. I've been looking at sets on shows I watch most for inspiration. So he's setting up basically, Dave, like a background set, like a living room or maybe the Starship, Enterprise, the bridge. He's setting up this whole thing and he's saying, what are some of the best practices for setting up a background that's going to be appearing over and over and over in your strip?
I like this question because I think you can break it down to three different types of cartoonists, all of which I have known or all of whom I have known. Cartoonist number one, Brad, like, gets out Google Sketch or whatever that 3D version of Google is, or they get out InDesign, or they're doing literally architectural floor plans from bird's eye view. And they're, oh, here's the desk over here and the windows over there. Here's the couch. And or here's the observatory of the Starship or whatever it is. And then I know cartoonists who are in the middle ground that have designed that whole thing. But then they go, but the window, do we need it for this shot? I don't know. And they fudge it,
Yep.
And then the third type of cartoonist is Dave Kellett, who does whatever he wants and puts a window wherever he needs it. And that's a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Now, how would you describe it, Brad? What is that, roughly the breakdown of cartoonists that you know?
I know each of those cartoonists, and I am each of those cartoonists. I have the floor plan for the main office at Evil Inc. I did in Google SketchUp. And right now, I'm actually looking to get somebody to build a better 3D model of it that I can use in Clip Studio. And I will use that. And there are certain aspects of backgrounds that appear very often that are set in almost stone. Like you said, a window I can make appear anywhere. But like people's desks and where the offices are and the entrances and the exits.
Yep.
I've got all of that. And it's very much set in place. If I'm not in that office or I'm in almost any other place, those backgrounds are built out of Jell-O. So I can if I need a door, there's a door. If I don't need a door, there's no door. There wasn't a door there yesterday, but there is a door there today. Absolutely. And if somebody is following so closely that they recognize that, good for them, but it's not important enough to change. the story is happening. When I get an email like that, hey, last week you didn't have a door on the left, and this week there is. I want to write those people back and say, hey, there's a story happening here. If you'd stop counting doors, you'd actually might enjoy the story that I'm telling. I stand by it. I stand by it because listen, all that time that somebody else is sitting there on a background that's only going to be used once figuring out where all the doors are. I'm figuring out what the story's going to be. And I guarantee you I'm doing a better comic. So I am each one of those cartoonists. I have a 3D background. I've got a wiggly background, and I've got a jello background. And I use them each depending on where I am in the story.
Yeah. And a part of me wants to just say different strokes for different folks on this, because there are people listening right now that if I ask them how many cans of recessed lighting are in the roof of your living room, they know exactly how many cans are. And then there's other people that never look up at the lighting in their house. They have no idea how many lights or recessed cans, or they have no, they just, you know, they flip a switch and the lights are on. Who cares? Yeah. Why do I care? But other people know how many black tiles are across their bathroom. You know what I'm getting at here is that some people have a brain that is wired for certain details, and that's okay. Yeah. That's a valid way to go through life. I'm not, for me, it is more about the actions and reactions of the story itself that are more intriguing. Yeah. But for other people, it's vitally important to have it grounded in realism, and I respect that. Mm-hmm. And Brad, I actually grabbed it because I have this gigantic story Bible, and people on the live stream can see it for Drive. It's I don't know, probably 60, 70 pages at this point. And the Bible, remember, is just the sort of background of the story. So I respect going into the detail and background work that maybe no one will ever see, just so you as a creator feel grounded in that world. And for some people, especially visually oriented people, having it really grounded in a 3D or architecturally planned out space is one way of grounding your story in realism. And I can respect that. Even if it's not for me, I respect that.
Yeah. And so if you're hearing that, I think the takeaway here, Dave, is that, You can do what you feel fits your style best. Right. In other words, if you're sitting there going, "Oh, that's not me. I'm more of a kind of make it up as you go along guy," I'm more of a, you know, make my background out of jello person. Then be that person. There's nothing wrong with that. In other words, don't feel like you've got to force yourself into one of those molds. I guarantee you there's some very well done comics out there that if you actually compared their backgrounds from day to day, you'd see doors popping up wherever they needed to be. And that's okay too. Don't try to force yourself into that.
And remember that different art forms have different necessities. So it's good that you brought up theater. But remember that as an audience member in theater, you are seeing everything presented by the proscenium arch at once, right? Yeah. So the audience has to have a fixed, locked-in stage, because that's a whole point of reference of how theater works. Mm-hmm. But remember that as soon as you move into TV and film, and especially as you move into comics, you literally get movie magic where, like, I'm trying to think of a shot. Like for Citizen Kane, where Orson Welles knocked out a wall and dug down 6 feet in the ground so that the camera could be at a worm's eye view for Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Like you as a viewer never saw that cameraman is literally sitting in the dirt.
Right.
But for movie magic to happen, that camera had to go into an impossible place. And cartooning takes that to the 10th degree, because you as a cartoonist can put the camera wherever you want, can put the lighting wherever you want, can put that window wherever you want. Right. Nothing is fixed. Yeah. So even if it's just for the balance of negative space, I'm always like, I'm going to put that window or that door wherever I want to put it to fit that frame, to balance out that frame, to fit the story.
Yeah.
But for other people, it's got to be a hard fixed rule. And that's okay too. So that's why I say it's different strokes for different folks. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. All right, Brad, well, our next question from patreon.com/comiclab comes in for our pal Dave Lerner, who says, "Hello there." Oh, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, I see what he's done. Hello there. You've recently said practice makes progress and, quote, "you can't get worse at something you do every day," which, by the way, we both believe in. Yes. Yeah. However, I have seen creators who actually have gotten worse. People say, "I like their earlier stuff better." Brad, how do we ensure that our current stuff does continue to improve over our earlier stuff?
Yeah. Well, so this is a great topic. I've got so much to say about this. For starters, I used to say it's impossible to get worse at something you do every day. That was the original quote. Since then, number one, it used to drive Scott crazy. When we would do it at panel discussions at comic conventions, because he would always whisper to me, "I know a few who've done it." You know? So I've changed it. It's very hard to get worse at something you do every day. The general thrust of what Mr. Lerner is saying has a gram of truth in it. In that, yes, a person's learning curve can be so slow that it could look as if it's non-existent. They could even take shifts that you think, well, that's not a shift I agree with, or that it isn't pleasing to me. But there is a part of all of this, both of those things that were said: practice makes progress, and it's hard to get worse at something you do every day. In each of those things, there's personal responsibility that doesn't get expressed outright. In other words, yes, practice makes progress, but you have to pay attention while you're practicing, and you have to go back and review your stuff, and you have to expose yourself to new learning, and you have to push yourself, and you have to strive to get better. It isn't an automatic thing that practice makes progress. It's not just repetition. Although repetition is a big part of it, it's also pushing yourself. Same thing with it's hard to get worse is something you do every day. That's true. But you do have to put the work in. There's a personal responsibility aspect to that that does not get mentioned outright. And I think it's something that we need to take a moment and talk about.
I think that if you continue to work on something every day, technically, no matter what people say, technically, you are getting better as a cartoonist. Something is being learned. Something is being advanced. Mm-hmm. But subjectively, I think what happens is once people get a certain technical know-how, they start to make subjective choices that scare off or deter previous fans from going along with the new choice. Like, I loved it. Your old line art used to be blankety blank, but you've made a subjective choice. I think that's different than not making progress. That's the subjectivity of art choices that sometimes change over time. Some people hate that I subjectively chose to turn Sheldon away from it being about a child billionaire.
Yeah.
Now it's more slice of life and a boy and his animals. And that is a subjective choice. Granted, that's about topics, but you get what I'm going with in terms of describing line art or coloring or whatever you want. I made a subjective choice artistically to change directions. A lot of people went along with it. A lot of people said, no, thanks, Tom Hanks, kind of thing. But I think that is one of my two reasons why I think people sometimes say, well, not everybody gets better because I hate blankety blank and I used to love blankety blank.
Yeah.
But that's a subjective thing. Yeah. That's not an artistic ability thing.
That's why I love this question so much, because it has a whole subtext that once we address the personal responsibility, the real meat of this question happens on the other neath. And here's what I mean by that. Here's what this person said. I have seen creators who actually have gotten worse. He has seen creators that he has decided has gotten worse. Doesn't mean they got worse. It means one person with one opinion has decided this creator got worse. Doesn't mean that the creator got worse, right? It's one subjective opinion. Here's the other thing he writes. People say, I like their earlier stuff better. I've got a story for you. Once upon a time, this goes all the way back to the early 2000s. We were doing Webcomics Weekly, and I said, I would love to be doing my comic in color. I just don't have the time or the expertise to color it. Ed Ryzowski got in touch with me, and we signed a contract, and he became the colorist of Evil Inc. I was so excited about this full color Evil Inc. I got the first results back from him, and they were gorgeous. I was thrilled to have a colorist. I woke up early that next Monday morning, and I published that full comic, that full color comic, with a big announcement: Evil Inc. in color for the first time. Look at this! It's amazing. I can't wait to share it with you. Love it, love it, love it. And I got the most negative email that I'd ever gotten up until that point. I got the most negative comments that I ever got up until that point from people who preferred the black and white comic. And if we believe this question asker who says, well, take a look. You say practice makes progress, but I've seen situations where people say I like their earlier stuff better. Well, I got news for you. People are dumb, and readers hate change, even if it's good change. And if you, and this is the thing that really gets important here, as important as it is to have personal responsibility towards your own art, it's equally important to know that when somebody says, I think you got worse over time, that that's one person with one opinion. You never listen to a reader. You always listen to your readers. And in this case, this is another case where you've got to even take a little bit more of a line on that, because I got readers, plural, telling me they didn't like the color comic, that they preferred it in black and white. At that point, as a creator, you've just got to put your foot down and say, I know better than you.
I got to say, as you were talking, I have a lot of thoughts about this. So this is going to be a long rant. Number one is, yes, people hate change. And art is not like a consumer product in this sense. When they changed Coke to New Coke and the entire world went into nuclear explosion, saying, what the hell is this? It's because Coke had been in stasis for 100 years and it had been locked down, and it was a considered and cemented property that everyone knew what it was. Art is not a cemented lockdown property. Before you came as a reader to Evil Inc., Brad had made 10,000 subjective decisions about line art, character, camera angle, dialogue, the way the word balloons, the way the panels work, a bunch of subjective decisions. When you came in, it seemed to you like all of that was locked down. To Brad, it's ever evolving, because today he's making subjective decisions. Tomorrow he'll make more. And over time, sometimes those, all those subjective decisions turn Brad 30 degrees away from where you thought he was or where he was going. But to Brad, it's the natural continuation of the 10,000 subjective choices that got you to the day you first saw Evil Inc., right? So it is a subjective and continuing change. So that's number one. Number two is, another thing that we haven't talked about is artists for whom I think leaned into their change and made much better art. And yet, technically, you could say that they were making worse art. And I'm thinking specifically of Oliphant and of Schultz. So let's talk about those. Oliphant. I don't remember what it was. Maybe in the 60s or 70s. He had a beautiful line art. Crisp, clean, technically perfect, right? It was a perfect line art. But here's the thing. It was, there's no other way to say it, but maybe some cold. Sometimes when you can be too technical, there's no life in it. There's no oomph in it. There's no energy in it, right? So technically, he made a subjective choice to move to a loosey-goosey, wilder, more Bill the Cat kind of a style than previous, you know, where lines are going everywhere and Oliphant was sketchy and energetic now. That is a subjective choice, but it's, I think it's one that worked for him. And yet I could see a reader of his from the 1950s going, well, this is unclean. And it's not studied. It's not practiced. It's less, but it's a subjective choice that he also leaned into. And I think personally made work to a tremendous degree, but I could see his earlier readers going, he was better when he was technically proficient. He's left behind his technical ability, you know, that kind of thing. The other one is Schultz. And I think this is worth talking about, too. There's a lot of artists for whom we like them in their 30s, 40s, 50s. But as they got older, or as they got a little more infirm, or as arm musculature or skeletal or nerve problems started to develop, their style changes because they have to go the way they have to go. I mean, Schultz is the wiggle in his line, which I think he very capably leaned into, was the result of advancing years. But he found a way with a very large drawing style to lean into it. And I think that's true for a lot of people that have either a musculoskeletal or nerve conditions that don't allow them for a technically perfect line, but lean into it and make it your own style, even with that.
Yeah. I think when it comes to business, I've said so many times, market research, not mirror research, when you're making business decisions, right?
Right.
Artistic decisions, that's a completely different thing when you really need to be true to your own self, because you're never going to do your best work, until you're really doing the stuff that you think looks the best, reads the best, plays the best, right? It's got to be your decision. You cannot change your artistic approach or your writing approach for that matter to try to appease a group of people. Because number one, you're never going to do it. You're not going to please them all. You're hearing, this is one guy. I think that person got worse over time. One guy. You cannot let yourself be derailed by one person saying one thing. But even more so, on a Zen level, you can only truly please yourself. And when you're doing work that truly, truly speaks to your soul, it's only then that you find that other people gravitate towards it. How many times have we seen people try to do comics because they thought they would be popular, right? Video game comics was the whole thing in the early 2000s. I'll do a video game comic because it's popular. And that person, if they didn't have that in their soul, they never did really great work. And it wasn't until they turned to something that they really had a passion for that they did the kind of work that drew people to them. You've got to do it for yourself. You've got to be true to yourself. That's the only way that you're going to do truly great work. Everything else doesn't matter. You've got to do the stuff that speaks to your heart.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other situations where an artist we could all probably collectively, subjectively agree got worse. And the only other one I can think of is artists who have found a better work-life balance. That means they've left behind previous perfectionism that was probably mentally, emotionally, and physically damaging to them. Mm-hmm. And to those artists, I say, you know what? Congratulations. You found a better balance. Even if your work technically might not be as pretty or perfect or note perfect as it was. Yeah. I don't know. There's a strong argument to be made for a better, more balanced life by not working 70 hours a week or not obsessing over details or not. So I get it why some artists who previously had been through a Marvel or DC system or a book publishing system or an editor that was a little bit abusive and had forced them to do a bunch of work and they had to get it all done. Yeah. And now they're like, you know what? I'd like to see my kids or my grandkids.
I'd like to have a life.
And so I can also see the argument for that in terms of moving down a peg or two from perfectionism to a very workable process. Yeah. You know,
I think the main takeaway on this is got to be for that cartoonist who's listening to the show right now that's trying to get better. The thing I want you to really take away from this entire conversation is not to let yourself get distracted by one or even a small number of people who have artistic complaints about your work. Business complaints, that kind of stuff, you've got to take that and look at it with a different filter. But artistic complaints and writing and drawing, that kind of stuff, I want you to take and get this idea in your head very, very firmly. And that's my infinite reader theory. Right. There's a nigh infinite number of people on the internet. Right. English speaking. If you're doing an English speaking comic, there's still even if you bring that filter on, there's still a nigh infinite number of people who are out there available to read your comic. In some cases, you just haven't reached them yet. Right. If you're in a boat and you're fishing in a lake that has a nigh infinite number of fish in it, do you sit there and obsess over that one fish that jumped out of your boat? No. You put your bait, make sure you've got good bait. You put it on the hook well. Make sure you're casting your fishing rod out there in a smart way and fishing where you think the fish are, all that kind of good stuff, and go back to fishing. You don't worry about that one fish that hopped out of your boat. Not when you're in an infinite lake of infinite fishes. you go yeah. back to fishing. So no, if one person says, "Well, I think your old stuff was better." If you hear that from a reader, "I think your old stuff is better," listen to my voice in your head. Get back to fishing.
I almost can't one up that, because Brad speaks such truth there about you have to love your work first.
Yeah.
You have to create for you first. Yes, the business side, you have to take into account the wider public and the marketing and how things are being received. But when it comes to the moment of creation, when you start a project, there will be people that complain. When you're midway through a project, there will be people that complain. When you have finished a project, there will be people that complain. Yep. So you have to love you and the art that you're creating, because you have to be an island that's self-supporting and that's building yourself up. And so if you believe in it, you have the ability to say, "Ah, to hell with them. I like the coloring today. Ah, to hell with them. I like the line art," you know, and you keep going. And then secondly, I just want to say, in a lake of nigh infinite fish, one thing that I've noticed, and this is from real life, I can't put bait on a hook. Soon as I cast, Brad, the bait is like flying 100 yards farther than the cast. Everyone I've ever fished with is like, "Do you not know how to put bait on a hook?" I was like, "No, I don't know how to hook a worm. Where's the membrane that like magically holds on? Because as soon as I put that worm on there, I'm basically just flinging a worm to his watery death 300 yards away. That's what I do, because I can never get it on."
And they tell you, just put the hook through the worm, and immediately the worm starts wiggling in abject pain. And you're like, "I can't do this. Let's just go to McDonald's and I'll get a fillet of fish."
Yeah. The worm has two working synapses, and both of them are like, "F you, stop putting a hook through me."
Yeah.
You
know?
And you're like, "Oh, and
they,
I hate this."
Immediately start contracting, and you're I've seen that before.
Well, let us move on to the next question, Brad, now that we've grossed everyone out. So this comes in over at patreon.com/comiclab from Cameron Davis. And Cameron writes, "Brad, I'm about to move to a new working situation where I'll be working from home as a full-time creative." That's cool.
Oh, nice.
"While I'm really looking forward to never commuting or having to come up with office small talk ever again, I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you keep yourself from going stir crazy or driving your partner or family mad by being around the house all the time. Did you take up hobbies that get out of the house? Do you force yourself to go out and be social regularly? Any tips, Brad, on how you structure your life to not wind up a crazy recluse?" So, Brad, the question specifically to you as a crazy recluse, how do you do it, Brad? How do you manage your hobbit ways living under the bridge? Do you always ask the billy goats gruff for food when they try to cross, Brad?
Hobbies? Hobbies? Do I have hobbies? Are you kidding me? I don't know that I'm in a good place to answer this question, because I am that recluse and I love it that way. I don't want it any other way. If you're looking for a hobby, you're listening to my hobby. This is my hobby, getting to talk to one of my best friends for an hour every week and talk about one of my favorite topics. That's my hobby. I don't have hobbies. I don't have it. What am I going to do? Put a ship in a bottle? Honest to Christ. No, I don't have hobbies. I'm a recluse. I'm a happy recluse. I don't know that I'm the right person to answer this question. Dave, you have hobbies?
I love how triggering this was for you. What am I going to do? Talk to another human? Get out of here with this.
Oh, David, when's the last time you talked to another human and it was actually a fun experience?
By the way, you are reinforcing Cameron's every question here, which is like, Brad has become what I feared.
And it's great. I've become what you fear, and it's a great life. I've never been happier. The more things go where I don't have to leave the house, I can just order that and you're going to bring it to me? Great. Knock on the door and I'll come after you leave. It's a wonderful life. I can't express it enough.
I know. I am such an ambivert that, yes, if I have to be an extrovert, I can be. But do I choose to be an introvert most of the time.
Yes.
And the thing is, Brad and I are probably the worst people to answer this question. Because like Brad, if given the choice, if my wife gives me the choice to go out to some Hollywood party or stay home, 1,000% I will always choose to stay home. Like, yes. I have to shower, put on a tie, and then go talk to people that I've never met before, and then come home an hour and a half later. No, I'll stay home. Thanks. I it's weird. But I'm happy. I love the life that I built for myself. Yes. I love it. I love the life that I'm, but I am very much that husband that SNL makes fun of in that sketch of, like, they take their husbands to the husband park to meet other husbands, you know, like the wives are like, he doesn't have any friends. He doesn't talk to anybody. I mean, I love the fact that I wake up, I spend time with my family, and then I most of my day is spent, if, you know, aside from business stuff, is spent thinking about comics and the stories I want to create. And I love that. That's what I always wanted as a kid, and I get to do it. And that's, again, this is different strokes for different folks. That's not for everybody.
Right.
I will say, things you can do that get you out of the house more, go to a gym rather than work out at home. Go for walks just to get you out into the public. Listen to Brad. Look at Brad's face as I say these. For people at home, Brad is actively blanching. He's just like, and not the good kind, like on Golden Girls. He's blanching. So, I mean, listen.
Take a walk. Go ahead. I interrupted you. Take a walk.
Like, join a softball team. There's adult leagues you can join. There are pickleball leagues you could do. Softball leagues you could do. Brad, look at you. The weird thing is, have you ever heard of that book, Brad? I think it's called Bowling for One or Bowling Alone. Bowling Alone, I think, is what it is. About how Americans used to belong to social groups. They used to belong to church groups. They used to belong to school groups, all sorts of things. And that Americans just don't belong anymore to any groups. They would rather be by themselves. So we are in sort of a change in epochs from being socially community minded to being more islands of one. And I do recognize that on a cultural level, that's not a healthy thing. It's not great for our politics. It's not great for our discussion to not talk to people, not to be around people. But personally, I'm very happy and I like it. Ooh, it's awkward. Yeah. I like it.
No, I agree. 100%
I'll go one up, Brad. The hobbies that I do, it's weird that they're all self-selecting to do it by myself. Woodworking, love to do it. Happy to do it. Don't need anybody with me to do it. I'm buying a lot of tools to do it. Gardening, guess what? Doesn't involve other people. Gardening. I'm happy to plant a bunch of tomatoes and cucumbers. Don't need anybody else. It's weird that all my hobbies are like, more time alone. This is great.
No, I agree with you 100%. Listen, Cameron, ask somebody else. You're asking two of the worst guys in the world for this. I don't know what to tell you. I can't tell you with a straight face to go out and join a group or talk to people. I got nothing. Can we go back and ask and answer the previous question again? Maybe I've got a few more things to say about it. Practice makes progress.
I will say this though, Cameron, because I'm not a joiner. I don't like to join. I'm not like I love my local Rotary Club. Got to go to the meeting. We meet every Tuesday at the Waffle House. You know, that is not me. I could care less. But I will say, Cameron, one thing that helps me not be a crazy recluse and also gives me just a pinch of socialization is a little bit of volunteerism. And that I would recommend.
Oh, that's because a good idea.
I'm sincere. I do that. It's good for the soul and it's also good for the heart that you just get a little bit of talking, but mainly you're packing up food for the food line or whatever. You know what I mean? Like I hate the idea of going to my Kiwanis Club. Like, that's not me. I'm not, or like joining a bowling league. I don't want to deal with four other guys that I barely know and bowl with them. Like, leave me alone. I want to draw.
Okay, so how crazy is this? I will not join a bowling league. Also, just because I don't want something that I've got to do at the same time every week, you know? Other than this podcast, I don't have anything that I do at the same time every week, right? But I won't join a bowling league. But if I'm on TikTok and you know how they have those live feeds, there's people who put their phone up during a bowling league night, and I will sit and watch strangers bowl for an hour. I will sit and watch that and be fascinating. I don't know any of these people. I'll watch them bowl for an hour on TikTok, but ask me to join a league? Nah, that's okay. You guys have your fun.
I wonder, Brad, if our answer will change when our kids leave the house.
Oh, I wonder.
Because I will admit that I've spent the last, decade and a half, whatever, my life changed dramatically where my social life took a huge dive, as does for a lot of people. Yeah. But that's because I was putting a huge chunk of my energy into raising nice people, you know? And
yeah.
so
yeah.
It will be. And I think my wife and I, me more than my wife, we live vicariously through our kids. They come home from school. We're like, give us, spill the tea. What's the hot goss?
Yeah.
What are people doing? You know, what's going on? And it will be interesting when they go off to college or when they leave house. If I will suddenly be like, oh, geez, I need something on my plate. I need to socialize a little bit more. You know, I don't know. Have you given thought to that? Because you're closer to that than I am.
I've got my older son just turned 20 and has a summer job now and is experiencing retail for the first time. And so it's actually, I've become even more reclusive. Because I hang around the house. I want to hear about their day, how it went. Did this thing happen? Did that thing happen? And then like the one time that I actually set aside time for that is to watch TV with my kids. Because we're watching anime and we're watching this and we're watching that. We're going through the Kenobi series. We're doing all this stuff. And like maybe when they're out of the house, I won't have somebody to sit there and watch Kenobi with, or, you know, me and my wife will be looking for something to do other than look at each other. I don't know. I love looking at my wife. I could spend a lot of time just doing that. I don't know.
But, I like that. That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that I'm going to get tired of that either anytime soon.
I think when my kids leave, my wife and I have talked about this. I think we're going to move back to London because it'll
is that right?
Yeah. I think it'll be such a life change that I will be forced to go out more. Cause I'll be like, today I'm going to the British Museum. Today I'm going to the National Portrait Gallery. Like if I move back to London, London is such a foot city that you can walk and take the tube anywhere. And I think I'll be more out and about because LA is such a car culture city that you can be an island onto oneself. You can leave your living room, get in your car, go to a Starbucks, sit by yourself, get back in your car, go back to your living room. Whereas in London, to go out anywhere, you have to walk. And Philly's more like this too. You have to walk out among the people and then you go to a pub and that's like the community living room and you have a beer and you talk to strangers and then you go back to do, you know, what I'm getting at though, is I think London would be good for me if I move there when my kids go to college.
Or an East Coast city. London is fine. You need to move to Philadelphia because everything that you just described there, farmers markets and walking places and all of, you know, that neighborhood culture, we've got that here. You don't need to go all the way to London. The other thing is, I'll be honest with you, when you get to the point where your kids are leaving the house, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to want to be all the way in London because the next thing they do, they're going to be getting married maybe, or they might be starting families. You're going to be that way, that far away from your grandkids? No. You come over to Philadelphia. Now you're just a short little hop, skip, and a jump to get back there, see the birth, and then come back here.
I've got about a 3-year window before I have to fly back to start changing diapers again, I think. So that's, I mean, go off to college. I've got about a 3 to 5 year window and then I'll move back. But here's the thing. My British friends always used to laugh at me because I would like walk home at 2 a.m. and stuff. And they'd be like, God, aren't you worried about crime? And as an American, I was always like, what's the worst that could happen? I get stabbed. Oh, please, please. I live in Los Angeles. Yeah. I'm not afraid of a knife. Come on. Like, so I always like the thing about London is, the worst neighborhoods of London are still infinitely safer than any neighborhood in the United States. So I love living in London. I was like, this is very fine for me. I'm happy to be here.
You're right, Dave. If you're in London, maybe you're going to get cut. But I will tell you this, it's time for us to cut this episode down to its end. You've been listening to another episode of Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
What a shot across the bow from my host and friend, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator and author of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend, the soon-to-be British Dave Kellett, co-director of the comics documentary Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and the auteur of Drive at drivecomic.com.
Oh, I say, the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at the World Record .net.
And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodstock. I couldn't do it. If I want to go back to being British, I can end every statement with a question, which I always find interesting about how British they always lilt up. Americans lilt down, but the Brits lilt up, which I was anyway. This episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And I will echo that by also saying Spotify is where it's at lately for growth for Comic Lab. So if you're on Spotify, do give us a review. It's helping tremendously. And we're growing fast on Spotify. So thank you. Thank you for everyone listening. And Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/ Brad's watching bowling by himself.
And loving it. And loving it.
Brad, I'm putting you on notice. You have to do a hobby. You got to learn one right now. What would you do? And does it involve other people?
No, it does not involve other people. So every now and again, I get these ads for these little kits that you can crochet little like animals. It's got a funny little word for it, but I can't remember. But they're little dinosaurs and stuff that you can crochet, and it gives you a little pattern, and you do that. And I don't know why, but the idea of crocheting or even knitting sounds so relaxing and meditative to me that if I had to spend an hour doing something, it would be something like that.
My heart just grew 4 sizes. That is the most adorable and sweet and heartwarming thing you've ever said.
Because, if you did like little itty bitty dinosaurs and stuff, you'd have a whole bunch of these things that you could just kind of hand out to people because they're just little things.
Oh, you my God, never stop talking about this. I want to hear you talk about your potential crocheted animals for weeks. This is the greatest thing I did not expect this in a million years. Oh, my God. If someone held a gun to my head and said, pick what Brad is about to talk about, I would never have guessed that Brad would have said, you know what? Just crocheting a triceratops and a little stegosaurus. And they're buddies. One's named Larry and the other one's named Bob. And they, you know what? They're cute on the shelf. I crocheted Larry to be blue. And Bob's he's a jaunty little gray. He's a cute little one.
Could you imagine how nice it would be just to have a pocket full of these little things? And just, you know,
oh, God. Oh, my God. This is getting better. You're falling down a rat's nest of crazy now. Now you're a guy in a coffee shop like, yes, I'd like the large latte. And here's a little stegosaurus for you.
And this is for you. I knitted it myself.